what they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few, if they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeiss.
And today we're going to be talking about what does a post-capitalist economy look like?
It's such an important conversation that we don't get to talk about enough. And we have a great guest, Emily Kawano, who has practical experience as well as academic experience and analysis. She's going to really give us a vision for the future.
Well, she's doing the frontline work in her community of Springfield, Massachusetts.
Right.
But she's also part of a national network and an international network for this new economy. You know, there's all this talk about capitalism, socialism, democratized economy. What Emily does is she brings it all together, and this is what it looks like. This is how it relates. Everything's...
People want to hear this interview.
It's fundamental for how people are going to understand what exactly we're talking about and also how to respond to the pushback.
You know, and the timing is key, because we're at this stage where there's lots of crises. So knowing what we're going to do when this crisis situation hits is so critical.
And we get into that as well. So I hope people will stick around and listen to that interview with Emily Kawano. But let's get into a little bit of news first. This past weekend, there were the Rise for Climate marches all around the world. Pretty amazing day. In San Francisco, there were 30,000 people out marching. It was great to see kind of the climate movement rising up.
And we covered that on Popular Resistance. And it's one more example of the climate movement building the kind of power it needs to make transformational change.
And we need to make that change,
because no question.
We can't continue, actually, we can't afford to continue this fossil fuel economy.
I think that climate change could be the cause of the next economic collapse.
Wow, talk about that.
Well, you know, we have what's called a fire economy.
Right. You're not talking about wildfires in California.
No, well, that's a good point. it's easy to get confused on that, because that's another problem. Fire stands for finance, insurance, real estate, and you can add energy to that.
Mm-hmm.
And on all four of those fronts, climate crisis could cause a collapse. Finance, the bubble of oil and gas.
Stranded oil and gas.
Insurance,
assets.
Insurance, the cost of the damage being done by storms and rising waters. Real estate, same kind of thing. And values of real estate on southeast and along coasts are plummeting.
Mm-hmm.
And then energy.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have a collapse of that too. So all four of those, it's a big topic we can't get into right now.
There's so much that we need to get in there and unpack the cost of climate change, as well as what could be the benefit of dealing with some of these issues, actually. And we'll be getting into that in more depth on our next Thinking It Through.
Right.
And you can access that by going to patreon.com/clearingthefog and become a subscriber. And then you can listen to that and our other
Just for a few dollars a month, you get a subscription to Thinking It Through, and we will talk in great detail about this climate issue, because it is at a catastrophic point that it could have a rapid change, and a lot of details there to talk about.
Well, some of the numbers that we uncovered in our research to me are really staggering.
Yeah.
and what those potential impacts are, and some of the ways that it actually impacts things that you wouldn't even think about, climate impacts. So we'll talk about that more, but there's a lot that's happened in the past week. Kavanaugh. I think the most interesting development is this new court case.
Filed by a Democrat groups against perjury for Kavanaugh. Multiple times in previous testimony and his current testimony, they are seeing evidence of him suborning perjury. Can you imagine a Supreme Court justice getting confirmed when there's evidence that he perjured himself before Congress multiple times?
And who's going to hear that case?
And that is the that is the funniest thing. So that goes to the D.C. Circuit Court.
Mm-hmm.
The chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court is Merrick Garland. Who's Merrick Garland? He's the one Obama appointed that McConnell refused to have a hearing on.
Right.
So he was denied a Supreme Court position, which he would have won if there had been a vote,
right?
Because the Republicans refused for more than a year to allow a hearing on him. Now, because he's chief judge of the D.C. Circuit, this court filing will go before him.
You know, we weren't huge fans of Merrick Garland, Garland for a few reasons, but I think it really is ironic.
It's beautiful irony that he's denied the Supreme Court position, and now he gets to decide whether there's perjury being committed by...
If there's someone who's a nomination for the Supreme Court and they've committed perjury, what other action could be taken?
Well, a number of things could be taken. But one of the ones that Congress could take would be impeachment. And not just impeachment to stop the Supreme Court, but from his current position as D.C. Circuit Court judge.
Mm-hmm.
Impeachment starts with an article of impeachment being filed by members of the House of Representatives. So members of the House of Representatives could right now, there's enough evidence, they could right now file articles of impeachment against Brett Kavanaugh to remove him as D.C. Circuit Court judge.
Well, that would certainly gum up the works.
That would create an issue that because McConnell's trying to push this through as quick as he can.
Yeah.
Because there's analysis coming out describing how it's even possible the Democrats could retake the Senate. And these are legitimate kind of mainstream
political analysis,
pollsters. And it's all because of Trump's popularity is dropping so quickly. And he's like the campaign weapon for the Republicans, but he's also a big risk for the Republicans because he's so unpopular. So McConnell could lose his power to push these judges and justices through.
So that creates this urgency.
The House representatives could switch to Democrat and articles of impeachment. So that puts Paul Ryan in the position, the outgoing Speaker of the House, because he's retiring. Does he allow a vote on the perjury of Kavanaugh?
Or does he allow a perjurer to go free? And then how does that play?
And so it's a lose-lose choice for Ryan, a lose-lose choice for Republicans. And if there is a vote, then Republicans have to vote on it.
Yeah.
Are they going to, and then all the evidence
about, are they going to support a liar?
All the evidence of perjury gets to come out more clearly.
Yeah.
And so this could be, if the Democrats, I don't know if the Democrats would do this. You know, they tend to be a little cowardly.
They haven't been known for their spines.
Yes, they kind of be a little cowardly. But to me, it looks like there's enough evidence that articles of impeachment could be filed.
Yeah.
And then debated and then voted on.
Well, another positive development that I saw recently related to this, President Obama is out now campaigning for the Democrats in the midterms. And it was really interesting. He spoke at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and he came up with this great new idea.
I know, a new idea. To solve a major crisis.
I know. Our healthcare crisis. It's called Medicare for All. Have you heard of it?
Medicare for All? Well, that's a new idea. No, we're mocking Obama, but I'm glad he came out.
Well, it's a sign.
It's a positive sign.
It's a sign that the work that we've all been doing to build this movement for national improved Medicare for All has made it so mainstream that President Obama has to be out there campaigning on it for the Democrats.
And it's a great sign that it's no longer about defending the Affordable Care Act.
That's true.
The ACA, no longer it's about defense.
We didn't hear him saying fix the ACA, did we?
Exactly. It's a major change for Obama, and that leads the Democrats who are already moving in our direction strongly. He did this after that poll that showed 85% of Democrats and even a majority of Republicans,
52% of Republicans
now support Medicare for All.
Yeah.
And that's even without good education. That's without putting the language in of improved Medicare for All.
Right.
So the seniors realize their situation will be improved.
Right.
And people on Medicaid will realize their situation will be improved. Medicare for All is going to be national consensus. It's moving in that direction now. And I think Obama's an example of that. What's interesting about it to me is the article you put out that reminded people that during the ACA debate, Obama said in the State of the Union, if you have a better idea, let me know. And so you immediately wrote a letter, laid out Medicare for All, brought it to the White House, tried to deliver it. They refused to accept the letter.
Right.
Obama then came to Baltimore to talk.
The next day,
you and Carol Paris, who's now the head of PNHP, Physicians for National Health Program.
We went down to where the meeting was. Obama was meeting at a hotel with a bunch of Republicans that were doing like a retreat. And so we stood outside of the hotel with a banner that said, letting you know, Medicare for All.
Exactly.
And the Secret Service wouldn't let us stand there with our banner. And we said, no, the president needs to see this. And we had the packet. And I said, just call somebody, one of his staffers, to come down and take the packet and we'll leave. They wouldn't do that. So
what I love about that, by the way, is the whole Howard Zinn thing. You know, Howard Zinn was asked by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, what should we do? And he pointed to our protest in front of the Baucus hearing where we went and protested. We refused to leave when they told us to leave. And we risked arrest when we did so.
Yeah.
He says, do the same thing. And then you and Carol took that advice, which he was saying you already did for the Baucus hearing, and said, we're going to go. We're not supposed to go. We're going to refuse to leave when they tell us to leave, and we'll risk arrest doing it.
Well, there's a little more to that story, because my first arrest, you know, with you were there, Carol was there. We were all arrested together in the Senate Finance Committee saying that single payer should be on the table. When I was on Democracy Now, it was also the same time that Amy Goodman had Howard Zinn on, and she asked him, what should people be doing? And he said, they should be doing what those doctors are doing, go where you're not supposed to go, say what you're not supposed to say, and stay when they ask you to leave. Well, Howard Zinn had died the night before we did that protest in Baltimore. And I was in my car in the morning taking my kids to school before Dr. Paris and I met to go down to where the president was going to be. And I was listening to Democracy Now! And she played that clip as a tribute to Howard Zinn. She played that clip where she said, amazing. What should people be doing?
Wow.
And so I'm listening in my car and I'm thinking, huh? Because we didn't really know what we were going to do that day. We were just going down there to try to get our packet and our message to the president. But anyway, I digress. I think overall, what's really important is that this shows how far we've come, and we need to continue to keep building. Let's do a couple of more quick pieces of news because the prison strike has ended.
What a great strike.
It was, they're declaring it a victory.
They did a beautiful
much
job.
Much more media coverage this time. So they're going to continue organizing.
We saw some demands already meant lowering prices of phone calls in some prisons. I mean, so there was already some progress, but they did a beautiful job.
And this is going to be a sustained effort. So we should continue to support our prisoners. And the point is that you can judge a society based on how it treats its most vulnerable. And if we're willing to treat our prisoners in so inhumanely, we're going to be treating others inhumanely. So we need to lift up our prisoners to lift all of us up. And then finally, you've been doing some really interesting reading about Russia and Russia's capabilities.
Well, we've reported on this multiple times on Popular Resistance. We just did another report this week about it. Basically, Russia has checkmated the U.S. military. They've spent 10% of the money that we've spent, but they've increased their technology so superior to the United States that it makes all of our aircraft carriers, and these are very expensive, and we're still building more of them, outdated. Mm-hmm. They could be destroyed almost instantly by Russia with this current technology and other technology as well. We go through the technology in great detail. It looks to me like Russia has outflanked us on the military, which is one of the key power blocks that we use to stay dominant. And second, they're starting to outflank us with China and other countries on the economy.
And excluding us.
They're turning the economic sanctions against us, reversing it, and starting to make deals, trade deals on big issues, not with U.S. dollars, but with Turkish money or with Russian money or Chinese or Iranian money.
Yeah.
And so they're cutting the U.S. out.
Right.
That will, if the U.S. dollar is no longer the dollar of trade,
that's going to have a big impact.
So they're taking out our two biggest things, money and military.
Well, I think it just shows the difference, you know, between the United States and other countries. Our weapons development is based on what the weapons makers can get the government to pay for.
And corruption, i.e. corruption.
Total corruption. So, you know, we're spending billions of dollars on the F-35s.
Which is a waste of money.
That
never
don't
has
do
worked.
Anything. Building these aircraft carriers.
Which are outdated.
And in Russia, they were like, we only have this much money. What's the best way to spend that money? So it just shows, again, the weakness of our fundamental economy.
What it also shows is an urgent need to remake U.S. foreign policy. We can no longer be belligerent.
Right.
We got to stop putting bases surrounding Russia's border with Europe. We've got to stop the Syrian conflict. We are looking for conflict with Russia and with China. We got to start to be part of a community of nations, not being a dominant, hegemonic, solo power.
Yeah.
We got to join the world.
They're responding to our bullying. So, and our bullying is like, you know, we're like little tiny ants yelling at them because we don't have that much power anymore. So
it's a new way of thinking for the United States.
Yeah. Well, speaking of a new way of thinking, let's get into our interview with Emily Colano.
Yes.
And talk about what this post-capitalist economy could look like and what that could mean. So we'll take a short musical break.
Right.
And then we'll be right back.
People of the world together. Join to serve the common cause, so it feeds us all forever. See to it that it's now yours. Forward, without forgetting, where our strength can be seen now to be. When starving or when eating, it's forward, not forgetting our solidarity. Solidarity. Solidarity.
the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers.
And Kevin Zeese.
And now we're joined by Emily Kawano. She is the co-director of the Wellspring Cooperative Corporation and coordinator of the United States Solidarity Economy Network. Welcome and thank you for joining us, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
So right now we're facing a number of different crises on different fronts. The economic crisis that many people in the United States and around the world are still facing, the ecological crisis, and really a crisis of democracy. Can you talk about what kind of approach would be able to address all of these crises?
I will be talking about the solidarity economy and using that framework. And the solidarity economy really addresses all of these crises in that it is looking to transform our entire economic system. And by that, I mean economic system very, very broadly defined. So if we're really going to transform our economic system, we really need to be thinking about political structures, social systems, our culture. So solidarity economy is a very holistic approach to transformation based on all of these aspects.
We should talk about the solidarity economy a little bit because that's a term I'm sure a lot of people don't know. But and for our listeners, I want them to listen to this because this does not get enough attention. People are all confused. We all see these crises, this amazing ecological crisis that is just degradation, climate change, extinction, the economic crisis of inequality and capitalism on many fronts, and then the governance equality where our democracy doesn't work. So we see these crises and people don't know where to go. And I think what I love about what you just said and about the solidarity economy is how it's a complex mix.
It's integrated.
And yeah. So give our listeners a sense of the principles of the solidarity economy and what it brings together to confront these crises we face.
Let me start off by saying that solidarity economy is very clearly talking about a transformation to a post-capitalist system. So solidarity economy's analysis is that these crises are driven by our economic system of capitalism. And we believe that capitalism can be tamed a little bit, right? We could have reforms of the capitalist system. But the underlying foundation to these kind of recurring crises are going to continue, and that we really need to move beyond capitalism if we're going to build a world that works for people and planet. The principles of the solidarity economy will look a little bit different in different parts of the world, different regions, but in the United States, the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network uses five principles that we ground all the vision in. So the first one is solidarity, and you could expand on that: solidarity, mutualism, reciprocity, cooperation, etc. So solidarity is one. Participatory democracy is the second one. So beyond electoral democracy, we're talking about democracy in every sphere, including, very importantly, the workplace. We talk about sustainability as one of the principles. We talk about equity, so equity in all dimensions, race, class, gender, et cetera. So we're anti-oppression in all dimensions. And the last one is pluralism. And this means that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, right? We are not about saying, this is the right blueprint, this is what we endorse. But different things work in different places, different cultures, different social, political realities. And let's try, see what works. And it prevents solidarity economy from being super dogmatic or a line organization.
So you mentioned that these are the principles of a solidarity economy in the United States. It sounds great, but how I think people are going to push back and say, well, you know, people in the United States are so individualistic.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to get a solidarity economy in the United States? Can you talk about the role of individualism in a solidarity economy?
Yeah, I think that in the United States, there is quite a lot of individualism. And at the same time, there has always persisted quite a lot of solidarity and cooperation and mutualism. And there's a great impulse towards that. And while on the one hand, I think our history celebrates individualism, at the same time, we also celebrate a lot of our collective struggles. And that even though I think capitalism really does try to emphasize individualism and competition and that logic of if we are all self-interested, it will produce through the invisible hand of the marketplace, right, the greatest good for the greatest number. It really tries to drum that in through culture and through our educational system. At the same time, that sense of solidarity and connection and might I say, caring and love, right, it persists. It will always persist. It is part of human nature for us to care about each other and love each other and have that human connection. And solidarity economy is recognizing that there is part of human nature that is self-interested and rational and calculating and individualistic and competitive, but also recognizes that human nature is about caring and reciprocity and love and solidarity, and that human beings as a species simply would never have survived if it wasn't for our capacity to cooperate and care for each other. So solidarity economy is all about trying to encourage those better angels of our nature, right? And not think that we should build an economy on the assumption of that more selfish side of human nature. So it's a more balanced approach, I think, and in some ways, not only healthier, but more realistic.
Yeah, it does. It paints a more complex picture of human beings and human nature than just the capitalist, competitive, greedy individual. And I think that's a healthier kind of way to look at human nature.
What's interesting about that to me, what's interesting about that to me is that even though you say individualism is so common and this whole capitalist ideology is so common, there's also in the United States history, a genetic history that creates this communalism. You can go back to the pre-founding of the country, the indigenous. You can go to the colonists when they first came and they relied on each other. You can go to mutual aid societies. Cooperatives existed for a long time, especially in a wide range of cultures, especially during times of struggle. And so there's a long history of communalism that is very consistent.
Absolutely.
So that's in our genetic makeup too. I'm not sure how much of this individualism stuff is propaganda by the, you know, neoliberal capitalist, Reaganist, Thatcherist kind of, that's what is being pushed on
that's
us.
That's the story we're being told.
That's the story we're being told. And maybe we're not doing a good enough job telling our own story, which is that we all actually rely on each other to survive. And even when you look at the capitalists, they rely on the community to build the roads, to teach the workers, to train people, to be the purchasers. I mean, even capitalists rely on communalism. It's like, and so I think we can reverse that story as part of the process. The thing that I want to ask you about, and I think this is the big challenge, that opportunity and challenge, because it's a two-sided coin. A lot of people will look at this, hear this and say, oh, that's no plan. Do you believe in socialism or not? What do you really stand for? You know, it's kind of simplify things into this kind of silly labels. It's so much more complex and people have a hard time with that. I'm asking a long question, but what I want to really get out from you is this concept that we have all the ingredients to make this transformation. And I love your caterpillar to butterfly analogy, metamorphosis. Tell us about, do we have the ingredients to make this happen? Do we already see experiments of it? How do we know it's going to work?
I wouldn't say we know that it's going to work, but I think there's a huge foundation upon which to build. And if you look around, pretty much everybody is engaged in solidarity economy, especially since solidarity economy certainly embraces unpaid, non-monetized labor, such as care work. So we're all engaged in really important, what should be considered important, valid economic activity, for example, in terms of raising our kids, taking care of our elders, helping out our neighbor, right? All that kind of care work. If you pay somebody, then it becomes a legitimate part of our economic activity. But if you do it not for money, then it tends to be invisibilized. But solidarity economy would say, no, this is really important, valuable economic activity. So almost everybody is engaged in some aspect of that kind of work already. That's a huge foundation. I can't remember what the numbers are if you were to value all that care labor, but it's huge. It's really huge, trillions and trillions of dollars. So that's a piece of the foundation. Then there's examples of what we could call alternative economics in every sphere of the economy. So in terms of production, distribution and exchange, consumption, finance, and governance are examples of practices that are grounded in these principles, right, that are aligned with the solidarity economy principles. Solidarity economy is not a blueprint. It is not a plan that's conceived from on high and then imposed or built. It is in some ways a theory in search of practice, so looking for practices that align with its principles. So in production, there's everything from DIY, community gardens, to worker cooperatives, various forms of cooperative production. In distribution and exchange, there are alternative systems of exchange like local currencies or time banks, and different forms of distribution like CSAs that are giving people a direct stake in local farms. In terms of consumption, there are collective forms of consumption such as housing cooperatives, co-housing, community land trusts. So I could go on, and there is a Prezi that people can access that looks at these different spheres, and in each of these economic spheres, it's populated by examples. Not exhaustive. It gives some examples of what exists in every single sphere. And I would say that when we talk about solidarity economy, some of these are alternatives. Some of them are very old, right? So cooperatives, as you say, are very old, have been around for hundreds of years. Some are mainstream. I would, and some people in solidarity economy might disagree. In the U.S. solidarity economy, we certainly embrace the public sector or the state as part of the solidarity economy. Granted, it is a contested sphere, right? We would agree with the analysis that says that the government has largely been captured by the elite, by the oligarchy, if you will, and it is not serving the people as it should. But still, you need to have that struggle. And some of those public sector institutions and policies surely would be keepers. Public education, for example, national parks, libraries, et cetera. There are many, and many public programs are keepers. So in that sense, some of solidarity economy is very mainstream. Some is alternative. Some is old. Some is new. To make that very clear, it's not something that we're just creating out of thin air.
Right. So a key is that to be considered part of the solidarity economy, an entity needs to meet all of the principles that you've laid out. So is there room for any type of a capitalist enterprise in a solidarity economy?
Oh, the good capitalists.
People are talking about, what is it, capitalism with a conscience, or conscience.
Green capitalism, triple bottom line, right. All those kinds of phrases to try to keep capitalism going.
So the short answer is no. The longer answer is certainly right now we're in a period where it's all hands on deck, and solidarity economy activists are certainly happy to ally with socially responsible capitalism. We share many of the same goals. In the long run, we would say solidarity economy's aspiration is to create enough of a center of gravity, right? Center of gravity in all of these economic spheres, economic social spheres, that solidarity economy is the dominant system. Just as right now, capitalism is the dominant system. So capitalism now is a dominant system, absolutely, but there are examples of solidarity economy that exist, right? And it is not insignificant, right, the solidarity economy that exists. We'd like to flip that. So I can imagine a future where solidarity economy is dominant, just as right now capitalism is dominant, and that the kind of the logic of our economic system is grounded in these principles. And it's really about serving people and planet instead of profit maximization. That does not mean that there would not be some survival of capitalist enterprises, just like right now capitalism dominates with a somewhat invisibilized solidarity economy. So I guess that's what I think. We have a really clear vision of what we're defining as solidarity economy. A lot of what that comes down to is about that ownership and control. So you can have an enterprise that is socially responsible and is very benevolent, right, and can encourage its workers to participate. And that's state, and it might look very much like a solidarity economy practice or enterprise. The difference is, as long as you have ownership by the capitalist versus the workers, that capitalist is always legally entitled to take that voice away from workers. It might be a battle. It might be a battle with the workers. It might be a battle with the union. But nonetheless, legally, that owner has that power. And so we believe that collective ownership and control of enterprises is really, really key. Some of these other things are really hard to get at. So take equity, for example. It's really hard to look at a practice or an enterprise and know, are they really anti-racist? Are they really anti-patriarchy? It's really, really hard to know. You can't just say, oh, they don't have such and such percent women or such and such a percent people of color or whatever, right? That's hard to know. You'd have to do a lot more digging, which generally is beyond what solidarity economy can do. But what we can do more easily is look at the ownership and control structure of an institution, which is not to say that those other dimensions are not important. It's just that it's hard to know the reality of that.
Really interesting. So, you know, especially I was down in Venezuela for the election. And one thing I noticed in Venezuela, you know, up here we call it the Bolivarian Revolution, 21st century socialism. And when you're in Venezuela, they don't use the word that. They describe it as a Bolivarian process. What I'm hearing from you in describing the solidarity economy is that it's a process to get there. It's not like we're going to flip the switch and we go from capital owning everything to workers owning everything. And you can do that on all sorts of fronts, but that's just one example.
We're being ecologically responsible.
Ecological responsibility. It's not like you flip a switch and suddenly we're ecologically responsible. No, it's a process. And I think that's one of the things that you talk about. And what I also find interesting in some of your work is it reminds us of our work in political movements. When we did the Occupy, we called it Stop the Machine, Create a New World. There were two sides to it. Stop what's going wrong, create what we need. How does that apply to the process of creating a solidarity economy?
Yeah, we talk a lot about resist and build. I find that this is a growing theme, right? Resist and build, fight and build, stop and create. I'm trying to remember some of the others that are similar kind of phrases, and different people talk about it in different, use the different phrases really to mean the same thing. In solidarity economy, pretty commonly we talk about resist and build. So resist is like your stop, right? There's various manifestations of the crisis and various manifestations of oppression that absolutely need to be resisted. And we need to not only resist, but we need to try to ameliorate those harms. So that's actively resisting the oppressive system of capitalism and imperialism that we live in. At the same time, I would say that the left has been more and active, you know, the social movements have been much stronger in the resist than they have been on the build side. And consequently, if what you're doing is resisting an oppressive system, but you don't have a clear sense of what you're building towards, then the danger is that you're going to reproduce the system that you're fighting against because you're making it better, right? You're making it better in this way and that way. And I think that doing resistance and making it better is good, right? Reform is good and necessary because people need to survive, and whatever you can do to help people survive and thrive is important. And I think that the difference is, where's the stop point, right? If you're stopping with, okay, we achieved that reform and now we're done, that's perpetuating the system. But if the stop point is, okay, this is transitional towards this vision and we have some clarity about where we're trying to go, what we're trying to build, then that's about transformation of the system. So I think for a long time, the left has been much stronger in the resist, and build has been almost viewed with some suspicion. And I can understand why. There's, you know, when you get into the actual build work, which my day job is, I'm the co-director of Wellspring Cooperative. We're working to build a network of cooperative worker-owned businesses in a medium-sized deindustrialized city in struggling communities. And it's really tough. And there are day-to-day compromises you need to make. I mean, engaging in economic development work really does mean, you know, it's complicated. It's tough. You have to get your hands dirty. And so I understand. And it's slow. It can be very slow. And I understand the skepticism that some people have about economic development work. At the same time, say we do really, say the resistance really is successful, but we don't have not only a clear vision, but we don't have the experience of how to run enterprises in a way that is democratic and sustainable and practices equity. If we don't have that experience, we're in trouble, right? I think the build needs to resist. And the resist needs to build in order to build something that's truly transformative.
That's interesting. That's exactly, that's our philosophy.
That's a good
too.
Way to put it, yeah.
What's interesting to me about it is that there's a lot more building going on than gets attention. The resistance part gets the attention. Because usually there's a deadline, there's a vote coming up, or there's some kind of event happening.
There's a dramatic protest.
A dramatic event that you're going to protest, and you're on deadline, so it has to happen quick. And so that gets attention. But the build part is slow, and it's, as you say, messy. But it's so good you're doing that, because I think that practical practice of getting in there, making it happen, feeds your theory. It's great you're doing both. But I just think there is a lot more building going on than we realize. We need to give it more attention. Right. We started out first with It's Our Economy, which is a website that focuses on building a new economy. Then we did Popular Resistance after Occupy. We continue to do both, but I think resistance gets a lot more attention.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners about the concept of Wayne Bibier or the good life, what that is and how that actually is put into practice in other places.
It is about, it's about living well or living in harmony with each other and with the planet and with nature. And solidarity economy on an international level, so I'll just mention REPES, which makes sense in French and Spanish. That's where the acronym comes from. So in English, it's the Intercontinental Network for the Promotion of the Social Solidarity Economy. So it's an international network with continental members that are in turn networks of solidarity economy networks. REPES has come out with a global vision paper that tries to, because before we came out with this global vision paper, I would say there was still some lack of clarity about what we agree on and what are some differences. And sometimes it seemed like there were really big differences across cultures and continents. And once we started really digging into, well, what do you mean by that? We found out that there was a huge amount of convergence. And so that global vision paper tries to lay out the sort of common foundation, even though there's a lot of difference across the world, there is still this common foundation. And one of the things that we did clarify as an international network is that we endorse this notion of buen vivir, which, yes, I mean, it's very, in some ways, very similar to solidarity economy. I would say that it is from the get-go much more grounded in indigenous perspectives of the world. And it's something that it has been enshrined in a couple of constitutions in Ecuador and Bolivia. And I know that in trying to figure out what does this mean, this notion of buen vivir, and another very important aspect of it is the rights of Mother Earth, which gives nature standing, which is a really interesting and very radical idea, right? Saying that ecosystems have rights and they have the right to exist. And therefore, if we are doing something to a local ecosystem that endangers its existence, its survival, we can't do that, right? It has legal rights. So I know in these countries, right, they're struggling with this. Like, how do you do that in reality? And it's complicated. I think it's very interesting. There are some places in the United States that have adopted rights of Mother Earth, and they've used that in a legal framework to fight against things like fracking. So I think that's really interesting stuff. Buen Vivir is very similar to solidarity economy in talking about a completely different framework with different principles and different values from capitalism.
Running out of time, but I want to get a sense from you about this issue that Mark and I have been thinking about a lot, which is, where are we in the process of this metamorphosis, this transformation? Because we see, you know, I don't know if you know the 8 stages of successful social movements that Bill Moyer did back in the 80s and became a book called Doing Democracy in the early part of this century. But we see ourselves near the end of the 6th stage, and 7th stage is victory.
Oh, the 6th stage can be a very long stage.
It is, and it's been going on, I think, for a while. I mean, we saw the Occupy as the takeoff, then we saw a landing. Now we're in the 6th stage, which is the stage of building national consensus. And we see the 2020s as a time of transformational change.
Potential
transformation, because the crises, the 3 we talked about with you, the crisis in democracy and government, the crisis in the environment with climate change and extinction and degradation, the crisis in the economy on all sorts of fronts. We see these crises coming to a head, and we see the movement getting to a point of maturity and building power on various fronts of struggle, whether it's worker rights or racial issues, police violence, inequality,
women's,
indigenous, climate, you know, whole range of issues. We're at this stage of building power on lots of fronts, and the crises are hitting. Putting that kind of movement analysis into the context of putting in place a new economy, a solidary economy where people live the good life, as we say. It's great you're saying this, because one of the key things in this stage is creating a vision for the future. Where are we in the process? Do you see these crises and the movement coming ahead? And how does the movement fit into putting this new economy in place?
I couldn't agree more that the crisis has created this potential, right? This potential for convergence and all of the things that you talked about, like all of these, both the convergence of different types of crises, as well as the convergence of the, not only the fight back, but I think you're absolutely right. That this building has been going on and is beginning to become self-aware, and the pieces, this is super important, right? The pieces of that solidarity economy are beginning to, regardless of whether people use that phrase or not, solidarity economy framework or not, right? The pieces are beginning to see each other as engaged in a common struggle of transformation. And that's super important, because we have these pieces where it's invisible, partly because these pieces are sundered from each other, and recognizing each other and making common cause and making connections is how we're actually going to build a different kind of economic system. So as an economist, I talk a lot about crises, right? Crises have created the conditions for fundamental economic paradigm shifts. So take the Great Depression, ushered in, still under capitalism, granted, but a fundamentally different paradigm of Keynesianism, right, which legitimized the welfare state, which legitimized government intervention to stabilize the economy and macro policy, right? And then the stagflation crisis in the late 70s, stagflation being simultaneous stagnation, high unemployment, with also high inflation. So that crisis in the late 70s created the conditions for yet another paradigm shift, which was at the time called Reaganomics or Thatcherism, and which we now call neoliberalism. So crises does create this opportunity for fundamental paradigm shifts. Hopefully this time, and I think we're still in that crisis, we're still in a phase where the economy is quite fragile. Even though, say, employment numbers are looking up, I think the economy is still has all those same financial fragility, still a huge amount of inequality, still a huge amount of unemployment, even though because a lot of people are unofficially unemployed, and that people's faith has been shaken in the model of neoliberalism. And so I think there's the potential to have a paradigm shift, and hopefully it's not just harking back to, oh, let's go back to Keynesianism. Hopefully this time it's a more fundamental post-capitalist shift, fingers crossed. I think we really do need to strongly articulate the difference between a post-capitalist vision versus just reforming capitalism. And then one other thing I would say is that I think we do have these crises. I think there is the potential for very dramatic paradigm shifts. But one of the possibilities is a very dark vision, which I actually do believe. I actually am fearful that one possibility is fascism. right, that we would will see more and more of an authoritarian state, more and more nationalism, more and more jingoistic rhetoric. We see a lot of that now. And so all the more urgent for this kind of work to go on.
Absolutely. That's why we have, and we've been saying, we have a responsibility to put forward a vision of what our society could be and to make that vision appealing so that it draws people to it. And that is what is going to be the antidote to the darker future that, you know, faces us. And this has been proven. This has been shown in other societies who have been in very difficult times, who have organized around a different vision of what they wanted their society to look like. And when these crises happen, there's this vacuum, there's this space for change. The group that has the vision and the organization, the know-how to put that vision into place is the one that's going to be more likely to succeed. So I think this is a real responsibility that we have.
And it's a responsibility we have to, before you ask your question, we have to be ready to do quick, because each one of these crisis areas could have a sudden escalation of crisis. The economy could crash. We could have another collapse. The feedback loop on the climate could create a multi-year sudden climate change, and the crisis in democracy could go to this fascist,
approach. Fascism,
so all three of these crisis areas could be sudden, and require us to act very quickly. So it's very complicated.
Right. So my final question for you is just, where can people get more information about the solidarity economy and connect or plug into efforts that are going on in the United States or around the world?
So to connect to the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, folks can certainly visit our website, which is just usfen.org. And there are links there. If they're interested in RIPESS, folks can just type that in, right? Do a search for RIPESS. There's a fair amount of coverage of Solidarity Economy, New Economy Coalition. There's a huge overlap between Solidarity Economy and New Economy. I would say if you were looking at a Venn diagram, there's a huge amount of overlap. And where we don't overlap is New Economy does not necessarily say that it's about building a post-capitalist future. So some people in the new economy space believe that capitalism can be reformed, but a lot of people are in a solidarity economy space. So New Economy Coalition is another place that people can go. Publications like GEO, Grassroots Economic Opportunities, covers a lot of solidarity economy. Yes Magazine covers a lot of that kind of stuff. Yeah,
the Next System Project.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They're less of an organizing wing, but they absolutely are publishing some great stuff on Next System.
Yeah. We try to cover all this stuff on It's Our Economy.
Yeah, you got it. Great.
There's a lot going on to keep track of. It's great that there's a lot. There needs to be a lot going on. So that's how a messy process works.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate you taking.
Fun to talk.
Yeah, great conversation. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. And for all the work that you do.
Same for you too. Wow, that was so great to catch up with Emily again.
Yes.
And I mean, we could have talked for a very long time about these issues. There's a couple of things that I had wanted to get into with Emily that we didn't have a chance to.
Right.
One of them was the idea of markets.
Very important.
People are told that, you want a post-capitalist society, you're going to get rid of markets.
Right.
And that freaks people out because they can't imagine a world where you don't have
where I get my food.
Exactly. And so I think it's important for us to make that distinction that in a solidarity economy or a post-capitalist economy, you're not saying that there won't be a market.
Right.
But you're saying that the economy is rooted in these principles. So yes, people will continue to sell items, but they'll be made from sustainably sourced materials by workers who have a say in their job, who are being paid a living wage.
The question is, who owns the market in part?
Right.
She really emphasized ownership, which also goes back to Karl Marx, workers own.
Karl Marx, who said that workers should own the means of production.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so, there'll be markets, but your supermarket won't be a giant. It'll be the workers who will own Giant or Safeway or whatever market it is.
Right.
Or Whole Foods or Mom's in our neighborhood.
Which stands for My Organic Market.
Organic Market. I mean, and so ownership is a key part. And it's really important because, you know, right now you're seeing on the political sphere, Elizabeth Warren try to differentiate herself from Bernie Sanders.
Because she'll be running for president, most likely.
They'll both be running for president, maybe against each other.
Right.
And so what's the difference between her and Bernie Sanders? And she says her difference is she believes in markets.
Right.
That's interesting phrasing. But she also says she's not a socialist.
Yeah.
So she clarifies that a little bit. But there will be markets either way.
Yes.
The question is, who is in control of those markets and how those markets operate? Do they operate in a sustainable way? In an anti-racist way, in a worker-respectful way, worker-ownership way, all those kinds of principles. So I think that's a key part, markets. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up.
I think the other part that gets pushed back is, oh, but if you go in this direction without capitalism, there isn't going to be any innovation.
Right.
Because capitalism, that greed for more money, that's what drives innovation.
And actually, the opposite is going to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get a lot of people involved, we know this in movements.
Yes.
Adding more people, not having one person in charge, not having a hierarchical, which is more strict, having a more diverse leadership creates more innovation because more people are involved with more ideas and more backgrounds.
Well, we don't just know it from movements. We also know it from direct experience with cooperative businesses.
Right.
That if you look at the data, because, you know, who knows better about what the problems are on the production floor, right? The worker who's in there actually doing the work sees where things could be more efficient,
right?
You know, sees where things could be changed. And if they have a voice, then they can actually have input into changing that. And so you find that cooperatives, not only are they can be longer lasting than non-cooperative businesses, but they are more efficient than non-cooperative businesses.
They actually make bigger profits, which are shared among the workers, which build the economy because more people have the profits.
While still paying people, yeah.
Doesn't concentrate the wealth in the one or two owners or the stockholders.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that innovation part, and part of that innovation is not just that workers are owners, is that the workers, these include the frontline workers. And so not only are you getting the worker's opinion, you're getting the person who deals with the customer, the consumer, the purchaser. And so that person is hearing from the grassroots.
Right.
And they're feeding that back into the business so the business actually is listening to their grassroots better.
Yeah. And then I think another important part of this conversation that we maybe didn't get into enough is just how important it is for us to have the vision.
It's critical.
Of where we want to go
so
right
essential.
Now.
So essential. Vision, I think we've discussed this in our Thinking It Through show that you can get it when you subscribe on Patreon. Patreon.com/clearingthefog. Even a small monthly donation gets you access to Thinking It Through. We've discussed this on Thinking It Through.
Yeah, in a few of the different episodes.
Yeah, this is a opportune moment for change. And we see this coming transformation in the next 10 years because so many things are coming ahead, as we talked about with Emily. But one of the key ingredients for that change is vision.
Mm-hmm.
What is this new world going to look like? What is this new economy going to look like? What's this new governance going to look like? How it's going to affect the environment? How is this going to work?
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about solidary economics and the way that Emily talks about it is that it really presents a vision. And vision is so key. You can have a good life. You can have what you need in your life
mm-hmm.
and live the principles of a solidarity economy. And what's interesting about the solidarity economy to me also, and I'd love to, because you talk about this a lot in other areas of work, is how they are consistent with human rights principles.
Right.
Equity, participation.
Universality. Yeah, I think what I love about the solidarity economy, it's something that should really appeal to everyone because
exactly.
it's a pluralistic approach.
Right.
It's not saying you have to do this way. It's
right.
saying, here are the principles. It needs to be anti-oppressive. It needs to be sustainable, equitable, democratic. But you can define what that looks like within the context of where you live and
right.
the culture in which you live. So it's really an approach that unifies us based on the principles, but the way that what it actually looks like, there's a lot of variation and individualism in that. But yeah, the human rights principles, the five main principles that we talk about in our work are universality,
right.
that everybody is included. So everybody should be part of this.
So like a single payer healthcare system, everybody in, nobody out.
Right. Or public education.
Everybody
it's
in.
Open enrollment schools. It's not like a charter school where you have to apply, or a private school. It's a public education, open enrollment schools. Every child has the opportunity to go there. Equity is really important. And equity is different from equality, because equity means that people have what they need to participate. So different people have different abilities. They need certain things to help them to participate on an equal basis. If you think about it, we often use the image of a wall. How do you get to the other side of a wall? Some people might, you know, be able to climb over that wall.
By themselves.
Exactly. Some people might need a ladder to help them get over that wall, or steps. Other people might need a door to
or
go through.
Or might someone put their hands down so you can step on their foot, yeah. Can pick them up.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever they need. But different people have different needs to get over to the other side of that wall. And then accountability and mm-hmm. transparency are very important. So we didn't get into this, but with the solidarity economy, some of it could be done outside of government. People are
a lot of it's outside. That's yeah. a real. I wish we had gotten more into that, because
community
this
gardens.
Is not this is not government solving your problems.
Right.
In fact, this is government being required to follow the lead of the people. People creating things outside of government.
Exactly. Right. Some of it would be completely outside of government, like creating a community garden in your neighborhood or being part of a community supported agriculture. But some of it does actually require government. You know, in our city of Baltimore, there is a process by which people can find an abandoned lot and apply to the city to be able to grow food on that
and
lot.
So the government's role is to allow it,
well,
is to create a situation where that can happen.
Not just allow it, but they'll actually give you new soil and things like that to assist you with it. And in New York and in Madison, Wisconsin, they have very strong cooperative
exactly.
movements, and the government actually gives millions of dollars every year to support cooperative businesses
right.
in their community. So yeah, it's exactly, it's getting government to support the vision that you're trying to get. And then the last one is participation.
Right.
And that's a strong component of the solidarity economy, is that they are democratic, that people have a say in what's going on. That's why we call our project It's Our Economy, and we use the term economic democracy.
Right.
But it's really about having a participatory process.
Which is something else I wanted to talk to her more about, but we didn't have time, which is participatory democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we are seeing a crisis in representative democracy, because it's not representing the people.
Right.
It's representing the wealthy. It's not really representative in that kind of democratic way. And so people...
And that's from capitalism, let's just say that.
More and more concentration of power and wealth
right.
results in... you can't have democracy
right.
when you have that kind of wealth inequality.
Concentrated wealth, yeah.
And so it you know, goes back to her point that everything's connected.
Mm-hmm.
The other... participatory democracy is a different approach. It's not saying do away with representative democracy, but it's saying give people power in decision-making. And we could have talked about participatory budgeting.
Yes.
Where communities get together and decide what their community needs after a series of meetings and working through the details, and then the government responds following the people's decisions.
Yes.
So giving people the power to direct government.
And that's being done around the country. It's much more common outside of the United States, but
right.
it is actually being done in cities in the United States.
And that's just one example. Another could be voter referendums or initiatives,
mm-hmm.
making those easier to get on the ballot, making them not dominated by money, by allowing people to have media access.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the whole media thing is another part of participatory democracy, giving people the right to vote on specific issues,
yeah.
having people in their tax returns, you know,
indicate how they want the money to
be prioritized. What are your priorities? How
yeah.
out of every dollar, how much do you want to go to the military? How much do you want to go to education, to the environment, and whatever? And so, you know, you can do that on a local level, state or national, or all three.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it would be determinative. It could
but
be
advisory.
It could be advisory initially, but
yeah.
that would at least then your representatives would be able to look and say, oh, my community wants the money spent on these things, and so it makes representative democracy better.
If people look in their communities, they're going to find elements of a solidarity economy in their community or opportunities to work towards developing it. So
I wish I'd asked her also about the basic income concept, that when you look at our economy, so much of it is not funded by pay. You know, people taking care of kids.
The non-market economy.
The non-market
which is
economy.
Actually, I've heard it's as much as 50% of our economy. And
exactly.
we couldn't have our market economy without the non-market economy.
And so if you have a basic income, that's a way to fund the non-market economy.
Right.
So people who take care of kids after school get funded through a basic income.
Yeah.
It's not just for that purpose. But I don't hear this justification made very often for a basic income. I think we need to make it more often. This is a way to recognize the non-market economy.
Yes, and compensate it.
That make the economy work. work.
Yeah.
Without people doing that, the economy would not work.
And some countries that have a stronger social safety net actually recognize that. And so when a child is born, they give as much as a year of paid leave to spend with that child during the first year. If
there's a family father member. Father or mother, not
actually,
just the mother.
They encourage the fathers to take time and do the child rearing. There's a family member who's sick and you need to take time to care for that family member.
Right.
They recognize that that's part of being human, that we're not just widgets that go into an office and produce, that we actually are human beings with human needs and lives and families.
What that's also part of is living the good life.
Yeah.
You can't live the good life if you don't have the ability to take care of your kids, to spend time with your kids, to
have
help
recreation.
Them grow up, to spend time doing art, to spend time enjoying life. And so having that part of the economy funded, I wish we had talked to her about that. I'm curious how basic income fits into her view of a solidarity economy.
Yeah. And, you know, for people who might be skeptical of how are we going to afford a basic income? Well, we've totally socialized our industries. We give them billions of dollars in subsidies and tax breaks. Why don't we turn that around and put that money directly into people's hands?
It's such a phony argument that we can't afford it.
Yeah.
Because when you put money into people's hands who need it, it creates people who can then buy things from the markets.
Right, right. And this is not, again, this is... These things have happened.
This is not theory. This is
exactly.
reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've run out of time.
Yes.
But let's go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want Because
The People Organized
Can Build the Kind of Future
We Want.
We'll lift our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love. Uplift our brothers and our sisters. The